Okay, we begin here on the top of Gimel Amud Aleph, 11 lines down. The Gemara at this point concluded that there are two different types of cheresh, or really three types in a sense. There's someone who is a deaf mute, which the Gemara says is patur mikol mitzvot haTorah. Someone is completely exempt from any mitzvot. He is parallel to a shoten, a katan, which is that he doesn't have a classification as a bardeya. On the other hand, we had someone who is cheresh, but he is midaber, he is deaf, but he is able to speak, or the other way around, where someone is mute, but shomeya, is able to hear. In that case, they are chayavin in kol mitzvot haTorah, they're obligated in all mitzvot haTorah, except in a case where we have reason to exempt them. I mean, there's an explicit mute in the pasuk. At the end of yesterday's daf, we saw that with regards to hakel, that there was a mute of the man yishme'u, or the man yilmidu. The man yishmu means that they come to hear the king say over Mishneh Torah. So he has to be the man yishmu to hear. So that exempts someone who cannot hear. The man yomidu, the Gemara says, exempts someone who cannot speak. The underlying assumption of that is that if he can't speak, he can't learn, which is what Gemara is about to challenge, whether that's really true. Is that really a proper conclusion from this? Then we extended that from Hakel over to Aliyah the Regel because of between the two of them. So now the Gemara poses the question, which is the Memra, Dechi lo mishtaye lo gamar. Is that really true? If they're unable to speak, that they're not able to learn. Bahanu tre ilime dehavu bishibute derabi. There were these two individuals who were mute, unable to speak, that were in Rabbi's neighborhood, in Rabbi's locale. Bnei brate derabi Yochanan ben Gudgoda. They were the grandchildren through the daughter of Rabbi Yochanan ben Gudgoda. V'amri lo, and some say they were bnei achate de Rabbi Yochanan. They were the nephews of Rabbi Yochanan. To chol ema to have a ayel Rabbi the Beit Midrasha. Anytime Rabbi went into the Beit Midrash, have a ayle v'yatve kamei. They used to go in and sit in front of him. They seemed to be learning. Umenayde v'reishayu. And they were nodding their heads as Rabbi was teaching. Umarachashin sviva tayhu, and their lips were moving, quivering. Ubai Rabbi Rachme alayhu, Rabbi davened on their behalf. Vitsu, and they were cured. Vishtakach, and then they found Tava Gemire Hilchoto. They knew Halacha, Visifra, Visifre, Vikula Ashas. They knew everything. I mean, that they were not encumbered in any way by the fact they could not speak. So why is it over here that there's an exemption from the man yomidu? If the point of coming up in Hakel to hear the king read the Torah is the man yomidu to learn, then someone who can't speak is very capable of learning. So why did you exclude, through the word the man yomidu, people who cannot speak? So Amar Mar Zutra, Kari Bey, so now they're going to make a play on the word and say that don't read it as the man yomidu, which means to learn, rather, the man yilamedu, in order that you may teach. Sort of, ashi amar, vadai le man yilamedu hu. It's for sure that's the right interpretation of the word. It's not the man yilamedu in order to learn, but rather the man yilamedu, which means to teach. So here, that's an exclusion for someone who cannot speak. We're not saying they can't learn. We're not saying they don't know. We're not saying they're not a bardat. But here there's a requirement that they be able to teach that which they learned. That is impossible just because of their encumbrance, meaning they are unable to speak, so therefore they cannot teach. Because if you think that the word is interpreted as the man yomidu that they should learn, became into lo mishtai lo gamar, and because they don't speak, therefore they don't learn, became into lo shama lo gamar, and also in the previous statement, man yishmeu, why are they excluded? Because they're unable to learn, because they can't hear. There it's clear that if you can't hear, they can't be learning from someone who's reading in a public address. So, hi, Milaman Yishmu Nafko. That we're ready, we can learn out for Laman Yishmu. If the problem or the exemption over here is the inability to learn, then Laman Yishmu already excludes people who cannot learn, excludes people who cannot hear. And if someone who had an encumbrance that didn't allow him to speak, then if that problem was that he couldn't learn, then he should already be excluded from Laman Yishmu. The fact that the Breita breaks down a second limud to say Laman Yimudu excludes those that cannot speak, then it's clear, Levadai, Laman Yimlameduhu. It's because the second limud is not about learning, but rather about teaching. And that's why it gives an exclusion to those who cannot speak. Those that are mute are excluded from Hakel because of their inability to convey or communicate that which they are hearing. They can't teach the same way that they are learning in that venue. So that's the exclusion. The Gemara says now, with regards to Hakel, the exclusion of Laman Yishmu excludes one who cannot hear but can speak. Obviously, as Rashi pointed this out yesterday, someone who cannot hear and can speak at some point did hear, because that would be the only way they would know how to mimic the sounds or make the sounds. It means they lost their hearing at a later point. Laman Yilmedu is really learned as Laman Yilamedu in order to teach, and that excludes someone who can hear but cannot speak. Both of them are considered to be bar deya, a bar dat. They are chayav in kol mitzvot. There's just a specific exclusion by Hakel because they're unable to participate in Hakel the way that the Torah envisioned. One is to be there in the public and listen, that they're unable to do. And the other one is to be able to teach that which they heard. And again, the other is unable to do that. So that's their exclusion. It's a specific exclusion to Hakel. And through the Gezeirah Shevel, we bring that over to Olat Re'iyah. But as far as Ashamei Simcha are concerned, over there, they're Chayavim the Gamrei, because they're Chayav in Kol HaMitzvot HaTorah. Now, Amar Rabbi Tanchum, Cheresh Be'ozno Achat, Patur Min Re'iyah. A person who is deaf in one ear is also Patur Min Re'iyah. Shenemar, because by Hakel it says, they will read the Torah Be'oznehem, in their ears. We need that oznehem to darshan something else, which means that in the ears of all of Israel, meaning that everybody has to come up. It's not limited. Where it says, how will me neged kol Yisrael nafka? That we learn out from the part in the pasuk beforehand, which says that he will read the Torah neged kol Yisrael, opposite all of klal Yisrael. So there, that's the public reading of the Torah. Im me neged kol Yisrael hava mina afagab delo shameh. I would have thought when it says Neged Kol Yisrael, they just have to be present. They don't have to hear it. I mean, part of the process is just being there, not necessarily hearing it. The Gemara says, Katav Rachmana Bozneim, teach you in your ears, Vhu Deshame, that's as long as they hear it. The Gemara says, How will me Laman Yishmu Nafka? That we already learn out of Laman Yishmu, that they come to hear. So there's two requirements in coming up to Hakel. One part of the requirement is that all of Klal Yisrael get together in a single location and learn Torah together. The other one is that they actually hear what is transpiring. It's not enough to be there. They also need to hear what is being said. So there are two requirements, but we learn one out from Neged Kol Yisrael, the second one out from the Man Yishmu. That leaves over the word Oznehem as a drasha to say that you have to be able to hear with both ears in order to qualify or be chayav in Hakel. Just as a side note, the purpose of Hakel, which is in the Motzei Shvi'it, next year on Sukkot, would have been the time that they did Hakel, is a quasi-reenactment of that which transpired at Har Sinai. You can hear from what's going on over here, and we're going to see more of these details later on, that first of all, they want all of Klal Yisrael there. Then the king gets up and he reads from the Torah, as if he's presenting the laws in a public venue, similar to that which is of Har Sinai. It's not enough just to be present. I mean, the presence is a big deal, being there amongst the multitudes of Klal Yisrael, but it's also important that you hear, and that you learn, and you're able to teach. I mean that this is a venue similar to what took place at Har Sinai, the conveyance of the Torah to the people, but it's a simulation of that public event. And that's why we have all these requirements in terms of listening, hearing, all of Klal Yisrael being there, and we'll see other requirements in a couple minutes. Amar Rabbi Tanchum, so here, Chiger Beraglo Achat, Patur Min Ariyah. So again, you have Rabbi Tanchum, Rabbi Tanchum. Rabbi Tanchum, again, consistent with his opinion, says that a person who is lame in one leg or has problems with one leg is patur min ariyah. Shinemar, because it says rigalim. Vaha rigalim ibaile. Don't we need that? Prat lekabel balei kabin. So over here, tur min ariyah comes from the fact that it says shalosh peamim, but it also says shalosh rigalim. So there's an emphasis on one's ability to walk up to Harabayit, to be Ole LaRegel. And if a person's unable to do that, then they are excluded from the Riyah. So over here, Rabbi Tanchum says, if he has a problem with one of his legs, he's lame in one of his legs, that's enough to exclude him from the Riyah. The Gemara says, wait a minute, you already used that Rigalim to exclude Balei Kabin, is people with prosthetics. They come to exclude it because it has to be Rigalim, it has to be your feet, your legs, and not a prosthetic. The Gemara says, how mi pe'amim nafka? Which is very interesting. We learned that out of Pe'amim. We think of it this way. Shalosh Pe'amim Bashana means 3 times a year. Shalosh Rigalim means 3 times that you're Ole the Regel, and the emphasis on Regel. We never thought of Pe'amim versus Regel being something that has to do with walking, but the truth is that the word Pa'am means to take a step, footsteps. So Shalosh Pe'amim, the Gemara here is not saying it's 3 times, but 3 Pe'amim means, the word Pa'am means to take steps, footsteps. And therefore, they see that as being the source for the fact that prat lebalei kabin, to exclude those that have prosthetics. The Tanya, shlosh pe'amim, ein pe'amim ela reglaim. Pe'amim only mean feet. V'chein hu umer. And I'm going to prove that to you, because it says in the pasuk in Yishayahu, tirmisena ragel, it will be trampled by the leg, by the foot. Raglei ani, the feet of the ani, pe'amei dalim, the steps of the impoverished. Ve'omer, and then it brings the second proof. Ma'yafu pe'amayich b'na'alim bat nadiv. In terms of proving that pe'amim means footsteps, you would have got that from the first pasuk in Yishayahu. That was sufficient to prove to you the fact that trampling with your legs. Raglei ani, pe'amei dalim. It's clear that the word pa'am there is referencing something about steps, footsteps, feet. So that you would have learned. But that's not enough, because we want to know that when you say pe'amim or pa'am, it means not only footsteps are moving forward, but it means something that would exclude a prosthetic. So how does that happen? That comes from the second pasuk in Shir HaShirim. Pasuk in Shir HaShirim says, Ma yafu pa'amayich, how beautiful are your footsteps. Ba'ne'alim, in shoes, bat nadiv, the daughter of a prince. So now you see an association between pa'am and ne'alayim, that the shoes that go on those feet. So that's what excludes the balei kabim. The balei kabim who have those prosthetics are not wearing shoes because they're using a prosthetic today. The prosthetics are so good that they actually put shoes. They have simulated feet and then they can have shoes on them. But in their day, it was clear that if somebody wearing a prosthetic was a stump, right? There was something that they put on the bottom of the leg to facilitate their ability to walk. So shoes were out. So that's how we exclude the balei kabim from the word pe'amim. From shlosh pe'amim bashana, pa'am means steps, means feet. It also means wearing shoes. And since the balei kabin, those with the prosthetics are not wearing shoes, they're excluded from aliyah l'regel. That leaves us over the word regalim, shalosh regalim, to teach us about reglaim, that one who is missing or has a problem with one of his legs and therefore cannot walk on it, he's also excluded from aliyah or the ri'iyah bebeit ha-migdash. So now, dorosh rova, my dichtiv, what is meant by ma yafu pe'amayich b'ne'alim bat nadiv? Kama na'im raglehem sh'Yisrael, Bishash olim the regel. How wonderful are the steps of Klal Yisrael when they come up to the regel. Bat Nadiv, why are they the daughters of the prince? Bito shel Avram Avinu, the daughters of Avram Avinu. Shenikra Nadiv, because he's the one who's called a Nadiv, a prince. Shenemar, Nidivei Amim Nasafu, the nobles of the nations have gathered together. Am Elukei Avraham, the nation of the God of Avraham. Elokei Avraham, Veloloke Yitzchak v'Yaakov. What? He's only the God of Abraham. He's not the God of Yitzchak and Yaakov. Why is Abraham singled out over here? This Perek in Tehillim should be familiar to you because this is the Perek Tehillim we read before we blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. So here that pasuk, Nidivei Amim Nesafu Am Elokei Avraham. Why does it single out Abraham? Ela Elokei Avraham Sheya Tchila L'Gerim. He was the first of the converts. So what's interesting over here is that Avram Avinu is given that status as being the first of the converts, but what does that have to do with Aliyah the Regel? What does that have to do with Maya Fupa Mayich? How beautiful are your footsteps, Klal Yisrael, that you're walking up to the Regel? What does it have to do with Avram Avinu? It might be that Avram Avinu actually went through a similar process of Aliyah the Regel and bringing a Korban in the Makom HaMikdash. Avram really sets that precedent. Avram leaves his home and has to travel all the way to Eretz Yisrael. Eventually, towards the latter part of his life, he ends up coming to Har HaMoriah and taking his son to be Makriv, his son, on the Mizbeach on Har HaMoriah, which establishes Har HaMoriah as a location for the Mizbeach, the Makom HaMikdash. So Avram Avinu really did what those that are old of the regel do. They leave their homes, they travel up to Yerushalayim, and then they bring Korbanot on Har HaMoriah, similar to what Avram did over his lifetime. So that's one reason to assume that Abraham Avinu is the paradigmatic character that we associate with Aliyah LeRegel. In addition to that, his conversion, which involves not only his converting, but also converting others or encouraging others to monotheism. So too, the Midrashim tell us that when Bnei Yisrael gathered together in the Migdash and there was Aliyah LeRegel, there was such a Kiddush Hashem that came of this, that other nations or other people who saw this wanted to convert. In that there was a feeling or a sense of the greatness of this nation through the Aliyah LeRegel that led people to want to join the fold, join the Jews. So just like Avraham Avinu did similar thing, which is that he went around and encouraged others to join in monotheism and to be Mekadesh Shem Shemaim. So too, that's what happens out of the Aliyah LeRegel. It's similar to what happens in Bavel. They said the same thing happened by the Yarchei Kalo. And all the people gathered together before the Regalim to learn Torah, the same type of Kiddush Hashem happened, and people were attracted to Torah and to Judaism. So that's maybe the association between Avraham Avinu and Aliyah LeRegel. Amar Rav Kahana, Dorosh Rav Natan Bar Nimyume Mishum Rabbi Tanchum. This Agadato is brought here. It's nothing to do with anything we said before. It's a non sequitur. But it's brought over here similar to the reason that it's brought in the Gemara in Shabbat. The Gemara in Shabbat, in Bamei Badikim, this Gemara is quoted, and that's because we bring down numerous quotes from Rav Natan Bar Nimyume. So since we're bringing down different quotes from him, this is one of those quotes. There it's in the context of Chanukah, it's brought in the middle of the Dinim of Chanukah. Over here, it's brought because Rabbi Tanchum is the Baal Memra, that Rav Natan Bar Nimyume says the name of Rav Tanchum, and we just had Rabbi Tanchum give us a number of halachot. So here it's brought because of Rabbi Tanchum. What is meant by the pasuk by Yosef Atzadik when his brothers throw him into the pit? It says, "Vaborek ein bo mayim." The pit was empty; there was no water in it. If the bor is empty, if the pit or the cistern is empty, of course, ein bo mayim. There is no water in it. So, any odeish ein bo mayim. Of course, I would know that there's no water in it. Ella mayim ein bo el nechashim v'akrabim yesh bo. That's a miut. It's coming to teach you that. Yes, there was no water in there, but there were snakes and scorpions that were inside of the bor. Rashi quotes that's memra of Chazal on the pasuk in Chumash. So again, it's nothing to do with our Gemara. It's a non sequitur, but brought here because of Rabbi Tanchum. Tan Rabbanan, Masib Rabbi Yochanan ben Broka, ve Rabbi Elazar Chisma, Rabbi Elazar ben Chisma, shalchu lakpil bnei Rabbi Yoshua bipkiim. They went to visit their Rebbe, Rabbi Yoshua bipkiim. As Rashi notes over here, it must have been Yom Tov, and therefore one is Michayev to the Chabed et Rabo, Bikabalat Panim, on the Regel. That not only is there an Aliyah, the Regel, in the sense of going up to Yerushalayim, but there's also a reason to go up and see one's Rebbe. We learned that out of the Isha Shunamit by Elisha. He says, it's Lo Chodesh, Lo Shabbat, Tayom, and it's not any of these special days that you're coming to visit, implying that one should visit on those days, including Yom Tov. So there we saw in the Gemara in Sukkah, with regards to Osek B'mitzvah Patur Min HaMitzvah, one of those cases of Osek B'mitzvah Patur Mitzvah is people were traveling to go see their Rebbeim on Yom Tov, on the Regel. So over here you have this requirement to go visit the Rebbe, and that's what they're doing. They're going to visit their Rebbe, Rabbi Yeshua and Pekiyim. Amar lehem, mach chidush haya bebeit midrash hayom. What chidush did they say over in the Beit Midrash? What did they learn in the Beit Midrash? Amrulo, tamidecha anu, we are your students. Umeimecha anu shutim, and we only drink your water. I mean that, nothing. We only learn from you, we have nothing to add, there's nothing to add here. Amrulam, afal pikein. Alright. You got over all the niceties. I know you guys learned something in the Beit Midrash. Yevshar the Beit Midrash lo chidush. There's no way that it was a day in the Beit Midrash, and there was nothing to be said for it. Shabbat shomi aita. Whose week was it, or whose Shabbat was it? This is a derivative of the story that we find in three places. It's a story that is in the Gemara in Brachot, the Gemara in Rosh Hashanah, and the Gemara in Bechorot. It came about because of the altercations between Rabbi Yoshua, who's a party over here, and Rabban Gamliel, that they had disagreements. Rabban Gamliel had a disagreement with Rabbi Yoshua in these three instances. One is about whether Mariv is Rishut or Chuvah. Other one in Rosh Hashanah is, and to which day Yom Kippur should fall out. And in Bechorot is as to whether a chacham can be matir his own mumim for a bechor. So there they have a machloket. In each case, Rabbi Yeshua disagreed with Rabban Gamliel. Rabban Gamliel mistreated Rabbi Yoshua. to the point where in the Beit Midrash they felt that they had to depose Rabban Gamliel. They end up deposing Rabban Gamliel in honor of Rabbi Yeshua for the protection of the kavod of Rabbi Yeshua. But then they needed to figure out how to replace Rabban Gamliel. And over there they go through choices. Rabbi Yeshua is clearly one of the options, but they say he's Balmaseh. He's one of the people involved. We're trying to protect him. It would be wrong to put him in place of Rabban Gamliel. Rabbi Akiva, he didn't have zchut avot. So they end up taking Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, who at the time is very young, he's 18 years old. He mentions to his wife that he only has black in his beard. On that day, he got strands of gray in his beard in order that he would be considered respectful for the position of being the Rosh Yeshiva. Eventually, Rabban Gamliel succumbs to the pressure and apologizes to Rabbi Yeshua, and they reinstate Rabbi Gamliel as Nasi. But they say, wait, we can't do that, because we can't knock out Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. He's the Nasi for a little bit. Molim Mikodesh, Vein Moridim, we can't take him out. So they came up with a system by which there would be two Rosh Yeshiva, which is Rabbi Gamliel would serve 3 weeks, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah would serve 1 week. So that's what he's saying here. Shabbat Shomi Haita. Whose week was it? Whether it's week or the Shabbat itself, whose was it? Meaning, who was teaching this week? They said, Shabbat Shel Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah Haita. They said it was the week of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. So it's interesting here, Rabbi Yeshua is not in the Beit Midrash. It seems to be that after the altercation with Rabbi Gamliel, Rabbi Yeshua left the Beit Midrash. It's not clear whether he started a new yeshiva, but he clearly was not in attendance in the yeshiva. I don't know if that's because he's older already, or because he didn't feel it appropriate, especially if Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah was the Rosh Yeshiva, then Rabbi Yeshua was clearly more qualified in being the Rosh Yeshiva, so he felt maybe it was inappropriate for him to be in the Beit Midrash, or that would undermine somehow Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's Nisiyut, so we find that he's not in the Beit Midrash, he's up in Pekin, or you could argue it was Yom Tov, so he went home, so that's why he was in the Beit Midrash. But you do have to explain why Rabbi Yeshua was not found there. So he says, what was the Agadata? What did you guys learn this today? It was in Parshat HaKel, so obviously that's why it's relevant to our Gemara over here. What was his drasha? It says, HaKel et ha'am ha'anashim ve'hanashim ve'ataf. It says, gather all the people together, the men, the women, and the children. So he says, im anashim ba'im lilmot. The men come to learn. Nashim ba'ot lishmoa. The women come to hear. Tosafot over here makes the diuk, that is in contrast to lilmod. Lishmoa means to hear and not to learn. He says this goes against the position of Ben Azai in the Gemara and Sotah, who says one should teach Torah to their daughters. Over here, it seems from this Gemara or this drasha that the nashim, the women come to hear, not to learn. Again, that's contrasted with the men that are coming to be lilmod, to learn. Taf, lama bain. Why do the children come? I understand there's a purpose for the men to be there, there's a purpose for the women to be there. So why did the children come? Kidei litein schar lemiviyehem. To give reward to those that bring them. I mean, there's a schar halicha, independent of the schar limud or the schar shmiya, there is a schar of transporting the child there and just being there. Being in the experience is valuable, independent of understanding exactly what's going on. Being present has value. Amar lahem, margilit tova itabi yadchem, you had this precious jewel, this pearl in your hands, bikashim labdami meni, and you wanted to withhold this from me? That's a beautiful drasha, beautiful explanation. And because you were being, all your niceties, and you didn't want to say that you learned something else, I would have missed out on this. Tosfot over here points out, kidei liten skar lemivien, he says something which is very controversial, he says, valzeh samchu, Lavik tanim bebeit haKnesset. On this, they rely to bring children into shul, even though the children can't daven, and they can't participate in the services. The Mishnah Brura, by Hilchot Megillah, as well as by Hilchot Beit Knesset, rails against this practice of bringing the children to the shul, because he says not only do they not gain something from it, but they end up disturbing the whole davening, they make noise, and they ruin the atmosphere and the ability to have kavanah in davening. So obviously there has to be a balance. It's an important idea, because they're always machloket whether children should be in shul or not be in shul. The answer is that they should be in there sometimes, and they shouldn't be there all the time. That a child who cannot sit quietly, a child that cannot listen to what's happening, absorb what's happening without interrupting and making noises and having to get up and get down and disturb all those that are around him, that child should not be in shul. Maybe for a short duration that child can be in shul, but then should leave the shul. For a child to be in shul who first of all, cannot sit, and number two, is disturbing the other people that are davening. It's clearly incorrect, and it's probably counterproductive in terms of chinuch, because then all you teach the child is that you come to shul, and then you talk, and you do these things, and you play in the shul, and instead of it becoming a place that has a certain serious atmosphere to it, a place that you come to daven, the child thinks that you come to shul to talk and to play. So that's a problem as well. So there has to be a strong balance between them. And again, it's important to note that the shul is not a babysitting service. You know, many children come to shul, the mothers send the child with their father because they want to break it home. So they send it like as if the shul is their babysitting service. Come in. It causes problems because, again, it disturbs the atmosphere, the conduct that would be assumed to be proper inside the Beit Knesset. So Tosafot makes the point that there isn't minhag to bring tanim, even though they don't understand, which again is good and fine and makes sense that a child should have an experience of going to shul. But that experience has to be limited to the ability of the child to be there in a proper state. Val darash. And now they bring another drasha from Elazar ben Azariah. Et Hashem hem martayom. Hashem hem yircha yom. As always, in Daf Yomi, there are no coincidences. This is this week's Parsha, that Parshat Ki Tavo, where it says that Hashem He'emarta Hayom, and again, the word He'emarta is very difficult to translate. Rashi over there says that it's a one-time appearance in the Torah. Hashem He'emircha Hayom. So you did He'emarta Hashem, and Hashem is He'emircha. So there's some sort of quid pro quo here, that you have this with Hashem, and Hashem has this with you. You made me singular in the world. I will also make you singular in the world. You made me singular or unique in the world. The declaration of God being the one God. And I will make you unique or single in the world. Shenemar, Mikam Cho Yisrael, Goyachad Baretz. Who is like your nation Israel? One nation, Goyachad Baretz, one nation in the world. So you see this, Miuchad, individual, unique nation. So first of all, this Gemara is quoted in the Gemara in Brachot, and this is quoted in the context of that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wears tefillin. And the Gemara there asks, what is in the tefillin of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? So the Gemara answers, well, in our tefillin, it is, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. We declare the oneness of Hashem. So what would be appropriate to be in Hashem's tefillin, obviously figuratively, is, Umikam Cha Yisrael Goy Echad Baretz. Mean that Hashem's tefillin reflect our tefillin. Our tefillin talk about the uniqueness of Hashem and our relationship with Hashem. Hashem's tefillin talk about His relationship with Klal Yisrael. Of course, all of this is mashal and done in the figurative sense, but the idea being that there's a relationship here. It's a two-way relationship. That we declare Hashem one, and Hashem declares us as also being one. Therefore, Rashi over here says, what is the meaning of the word He'emarta? So he says the word means shibachta, that you praised. Kamo itamru kol pol aven, ishtabchu, and chativachat. Again, what is a chativachat? Shevach echad, shevach miuchad. A singular, unique praise is what he says over here. So Rashi claims the word He'emarta means to praise. There are different interpretations brought by the Mefarshim over there, and each one of them might describe a different stage or a different closeness in the relationship, which is here, the word He'emarta is used, means to praise. That seems to be somewhat of a more distant or external type of relationship. You could also say the word He'emarta comes from the word amira, to speak, which is that one of two interpretations that you could suggest over here. I heard from my brother-in-law, I suggested Amira means that when one speaks, you recognize the other in that speech. So that when you see a Jew, then you would automatically realize that they are connected to Hashem. Or when you see, if you quote-unquote saw Hashem, then we know that it was connected to Klal Yisrael. They're so joined, they're so together, that the seeing one or the speech of one automatically reminds you of the other. So if you see a Jew speak, you see a Jew conduct themselves, that right away would remind you of godliness. That would be one way to read the Amira. I would suggest that Amira means, sometimes whether it's a couple or people are very close, that they can finish each other's sentences. That type of closeness, which is the Amira, that if you're saying something, the other person is so in sync with you that they could finish whatever you're saying, or they can know what you're going to say. So that it describes a certain amount of closeness that's way beyond just shevach of praise, but it's a relationship of familiarity and closeness, so much so that you almost become one. So that's other interpretations. You can see the Mefarshim and Hamarta, they give different descriptions of what the word is, or trying to translate the word, but obviously it's describing a relationship between Hashem and Bnei Yisrael, but depending on which interpretation you pick, it might describe how close the relationship is, or how tight, and maybe they're all true, which is that at different stages or at different times, we have these different relationships. We always have a relationship with Hashem. Sometimes it's a little more distance, and sometimes it's a little closer. And that might be this ambiguity of the word Hamarta, which can be translated in many different ways. All right, now the Gemara continues and says, Vafu patach vidarash. And then he went ahead and opened and made a drasha. Here we have something dangling modifier. Who is the who here that did this? We have two characters in the story. One is Rabbi Yeshua, who's hearing from his Talmidim what transpired in the Beit Midrash. The other one is that they're conveying over what Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah said. So af hu could refer to either Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, or it could refer to Rabbi Yeshua. Rashi reads it as referring to Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah. This is a third drasha of Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah. But if you look down in the Hagot Meranshenberg, he says that in the Marsha, he thinks the Girsa is Perish Rabbi Yeshua patach v'darash. Then Rabbi Yeshua kicked in and gave the drasha. And now we hear what they said in the Midrash. Now Rabbi Yeshua is Doresh. So it's unclear which one it is, and you have interpretations in both directions. Havu v'darach darash. Divrei chachamim kidarbonot. The words of the chachamim are like prodders that direct the animals. Uchemas mirot nituim. And like nails that are kavua, or stuck, or put in place. Balei asufot nitenu merue echad. The owners of the gathering in were all given from one ruah, from one shepherd. And now the Gemara is going to darshan this, or Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah is going to darshan this. Lama nimshalu divrei Torah ledarban. Why are divrei Torah compared to a prodder? Lamalacha, ma darban ze mikavenet apara letalmeha. Just like this prodder helps to keep the oxen directed on their furrows, lo tzi chayim le'olam, to produce life for the world. So obviously talking about plowing in a field in the area where there's going to be produce. So here the darban directs the animals to help with the production, the food production. Af divrei Torah mikavnim et lomdehem midarkei mita ledarkei chayim. So too, the words of Torah give direction to the individual, so they lead a life that brings them to a way of life rather than a way of death. Imar darban ze mitaltel. Just like this darban can be taken up and moved around and is not a fixture. Av divrei Torah mitaltelin. Maybe the same is true of divrei Torah, meaning that they're not permanent. They're not a fixture. Talmud Omar masmerot. Even though masmerot there is spelled with a sin, not a samach. But masmerot meaning nails. Nails are something that you bang in and that remain a fixture, that they're affixed in place. So when it says, Imam masmer zeh chaser velo yeter, just like a nail, when you bang a nail in, it disappears into the wall. I mean, it disappears into the location where you bang it in. It's as if it's not there anymore. Af divrei Torah chaserim velo yeterim. Maybe divrei Torah, again, are missing things or they lose out on things and not additive. Talmud Omar nituim. Then the pasuk continues and says that they are like nails that are planted, we're going to say. Ma nitiya zu pare urve. Just like this nitiya, this plant, this tree, grows and increases. After divrei Torah, parin viravin. So too, divrei Torah are not static. They are dynamic. And divrei Torah, therefore, will increase and expand. Bale asufot. Who are the bale asufot here? Elu tamide chachamim. Why are they the chachamim? Yoshvim asufot asufot. Because they sit in groups and groups, voskim be Torah. I would suggest also Balei HaSufot, which is that they gather together. They are the harvesters, they bring together the Torah. They bring it all into a singular location, which is someone who learns all of this and tries to bring it together, to distill it, to make it into something that they can convey to others. Now, when these groups are together, halalu mitamin. Some people say tamei, v'halalu mitaharim, and others say tahor. Halalu osrim, some say asur, v'halalu matirim. Halu poslim, some say pasul, halu makshrim, and say that it's kasher. Shema yomar adam, heich ani lomid Torah, miata. How can I learn Torah now? Because there's so many different opinions. How am I going to deal with the multitude of opinions? Tamar Lomar, the Pasuk says, Kulam Nitnu Miroe Echad. They were all given from one shepherd. Kel Echad Natnan. One God conveyed or gave over the Torah. Parnas Achad Amaran. One leader said them over. Miepi Adon Kolam Asim Baruchu. From God himself. So the Torah has a singular base or a singular start, which is it came from HaKadosh Baruch Hu and was conveyed through Moshe Rabbeinu. And we don't find anybody undermining the words of Moshe Rabbeinu or undermining the Torah itself. So the Torah is expansive. It's not something that is limited. But that expansion all derives from a singular source or a singular root. So that's why it's all correct. Ikhtiv. By Deberet Elokim, it's called Vrim Eila. God spoke all of these words, as the introduction by the Aseret HaDibrot, through Moshe Rabbeinu. Afata, aseh az oznecha ke'afar keset. You should make your ears like either a hopper or a funnel. That's by the mill, the hopper or the funnel. V'kenei lecha leiv mevin lishmoa et divrei mitamim, et divrei mitarim, et divrei osim, et divrei matirim, et divrei poslim, et divrei makshirin. So you should make your ears like a hopper, like a funnel, and you should have a heart that is able to understand and to gather in all of this information, meaning that you hear what everybody has to say, tamei, tahor, asur, mutar, pasul, kasher, you listen to all of this. B'shona ze amar lehem, ein dor yatom, shirob lazar ben Izariah sharui b'tochol. Says there's no generation that is orphaned when Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah is in it. So now, that's why Rashi likely said that the third drasha was from Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah. You could argue that Rabbi Yeshua was saying this as a compliment to Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, saying that there are many different views of the Torah. And just because Rabbi Yeshua knows that he's a Talmud Chacham, Rabbi Yeshua is a greater Talmud Chacham than Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah, and that's why he might not have been in the Beit Midrash, nevertheless, Rabbi Lazar ben Azariah had something to add. And that's because everybody has something to add, whether he's Mitameh or Mitaher, Kasher, Pasul. The process of Torah and the development of Torah is that each of those opinions is incorporated, and that's what helps us to keep the Torah dynamic and alive, which is, even maybe it's not accepted the halacha, nevertheless, it is part of the process of developing the halacha or developing Torah. And therefore, there's multiple facets to Torah. You know, many times we say, Shivim Panim the Torah. Here it's also true, and that's what Rashi says. Over here, da, divrei kulan, nowhere what everybody has to say. And then when you know which one is the right one, then you'll be kovel halacha. So there's two stages in learning. There's one stage in learning, which is the collection phase, which is that you collect all the different opinions, you gather in all the Torah, you harvest all the Torah. And then there's a second stage, which is the borer stage, where you start to determine which is right, which is wrong, and make sense of everything that you've learned. And it's an important part of learning and understanding is that many people feel that they have the right to paskin or they have the ability to paskin when they're only in the gathering stage. They're only in the harvesting stage. You have to have a complete gathering or harvesting and the gathering of knowledge before you can paskin. So they say here, stop worrying about the fact that they're contradictory opinions. Stop worrying about the fact that you're going to get multiple facets. Gather it all in and then you'll start to distill it. But you have to have the whole picture before you can start to make sense of everything that's there. So Gemara asks here, Limur Lebe Hedja, why didn't they say to Rabbi Yeshua right away when he asked them about what was transpiring in the Beit Midrash, why didn't they say right away what happened? Why did they do this niceties, they defer and say, no, we only learn from you. Because they had heard about another incident, which they didn't want to be a party to, so they were protecting themselves, or covering themselves. Netanya, Maseh b'Rabbi Yossi ben Dumaskit, Shalach lakbil p'nei b'lozer b'lud. So he was going to see his Rebbe, Rabbi Elazar Belud. It's unlikely that it was actually Rabbi Elazar. It probably was Rabbi Eliezer, because Rabbi Elazar is actually in Belud, but we know that from the Haggadah. It probably was Rabbi Eliezer. Tosafot over here, the Gerson Tosafot is also Rabbi Eliezer, which would indicate that it was Rabbi Elazar ben Hurkunos. So he went to visit him, and he also might have been someone who wasn't in the Beit Midrash, because he was a peer of Rabbi Yoshua's. He might not have been in the Beit Midrash either, because he was put into Shamta, Rabbi Elazar ben Hurkunos, or... Because again, with this whole altercation, Rabbi Gamliel and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, you might not have been there. So Rabbi Yossi ber Demuskit goes to visit him. Amlo, ma chidush haya bebei midrash yom. So he says, what did you learn? What chidush was there in the Beit Midrash today? So Amlo, nimnu vigamru. They came to the conclusion that this should be the halacha. So he didn't wait. He didn't demur in any way. He simply said what they learned in the Beit Midrash. As if, look, you know what we learned today? It says, Nimnu v'gamru, they came to the conclusion, Amon Moab masrim maser ani b'shvit. Amon Moab, which is Ever Yardain, we'll discuss exactly what that is, are taking off maser ani during shvi'it, which is coming up. This is a walk on the maser. Amar lo, Yosi, pashot yadecha, stretch out your hands, v'kabel einecha, and let, have your eyes fall into your hands. So obviously he's upset at him. He's, whatever he did now, he affronted him, or he did something that was inappropriate. So pashat yadav, v'kabel einecha, he stuck out his hands and his eyes popped out. Bacha Rabbi Lazar, Rabbi Eliezer, v'amar, sod Hashem l'reyav, ubrito lehodiyam. The secrets of Hashem are to those that fear him, and his covenant, lehodiyam, he tells them about it. Amlo leich amor lehem. He should go tell them in the Beit Midrash, al tachushu leminyanchem. Don't worry about what you paskind. I mean, they were debating whether to paskind this way, and they paskind this way. He says, don't worry about it. Kach mikublani mirab Yochanan ben Zakkai. I have a Kabbalah from Yochanan ben Zakkai. We know that Rabbi Lezer ben Hurkunos was one of the five Talmidim of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, although Rabbi Lezer ben Arach was also a Talmid of his. So it could be Rabbi Elazar, but it seems like it was Rabbi Eliezer. Sheshama mirabo, rabo mirabo. He had a misora. Hilchotah lemoshe misinai. Halacha lemoshe misinai. Now there's a question here whether this really means halacha lemoshe misinai or means as if it was halacha lemoshe misinai. Because Rashi over here quotes that it's from the time of the Anshei Knesset Agdola, which seems to be that it was a takana in that time and not from halacha lemoshe misinai. Or it might be that part of it is halacha lemoshe misinai. And then there's an institution which came out of the Anshei Knesset Agdola, which is Amon Moab Masrim Maser Ani B'Shvi'it. That the Amon Moab Eivre Yardin takes off Maser Ani during the Shvi'it. So he says, don't worry about the fact that you pass an halacha like that way. That is the halacha. Matam, what's the reason for that? Harbei krachim kavshu ole Mitzrayim. Those that came out of Mitzrayim conquered large swaths of land in Eretz Yisrael. Velo kavshu ole Bavel. And the people who came up from a Bavel at that period of time, they did not conquer the same areas. They had a much smaller area that was considered to be Eretz Yisrael at the time of the second Beit HaMikdash versus the first Beit HaMikdash. When they were ole into Eretz Yisrael from the time they left Mitzrayim, they conquered huge areas, Eber Yardain, north, south, all over the place, that were all imbued with Kedushat Aretz. But then when they returned after Galut Bavel, in that time they had a much more consolidated or concentrated part of Eretz Yisrael, which was centered around Yerushalayim and towards the center of the country. It didn't go very far north or very far south, a little bit to the east and the west, those areas. So now, why did they do that? Mivnei, Shekedusha Rishona Kitchel Shaita Velo Kitchel Atid Lavo. It is because the Kedusha Rishuna, the Kedusha that was imbued in Eretz Yisrael by the time of Yoshua bin Nun, was not permanent, it was only temporary. Ve'nichum, Kadesh Yismuchu Aleihem Aniyim B'Shvi'it. And so the Olei Bavel, when they came up and were Mekadesh, and it sounds like from here that they were Mekadesh permanently, that Kedusha has permanence to it. Nevertheless, they left cities on the perimeter that they were not Mekadesh, in order that during Shvi'it, when there was nothing to eat and there was no produce in the land, they would have areas adjacent that would have produce, and they would take Maaser Ani. The Aniyim could go out there and get food during Shvi'it. So that halacha lemaaseh has huge implications today. First of all, in terms of Eivre Yardain, it's not clear that Eivre Yardain does not have that Kedusha and does not have Shvi'it, because the Mishnah in Shvi'it and in other places talks about Shlosh Aratzot. There are three areas of land that we divide up in terms of Perot Shvi'it and in terms of Bior Perut Shvi'it, which is Galil, Yehuda, and Eivre Yardain. So Eivre Yardain is named as one of the areas that has Kedushat Shvi'it and has Bior Shvi'it. So what the Rabbeinu Tam says over here is, wait a minute, it's not all of Eivre Yardain. Eivre Yardain can be split between those areas that were not Amon and Moab directly, but were conquered by Sihon and Og. And the Sihon and Og, after conquering them, allowed Bnei Yisrael to conquer them, because Bnei Yisrael were not allowed to conquer Amon and Moab's land. And therefore, only those areas that have Sichon and Og have that Kedusha. But to the east of that, Amon and Moab that remained, they do not have this Kedusha. That's one way to explain it. Or you could explain it that it's the areas of Moab that were conquered on the belt that's along the Yardain, but not the areas to the east, which weren't necessarily conquered by Moshe Rabbeinu. So that's how the Rabbeinu Tam deals with it. Number two, it also has huge implications today in terms of Kedushat Shvi'it and having produce and food during the Shvi'it, which is as very difficult to have produce when you're letting the fields lay fallow. So obviously there's Heter Mechira, which has its own controversy surrounding it, but many use this Heter as a way to provide for produce during the Shvi'it, which is that they go to areas, they plant in areas that were not nitkadesh by Olei Bavel, in the areas in the south. Gush Katif, by the way, happened to be one of those areas that was a major producer during the Shvi'it because they're outside of the areas that were conquered by Olei Bavel. So once you move outside of those areas, they probably do not have Kedushat Shvi'it. So in general, we try to combine a second heter along with being outside of the areas of Olei Bavel. So for instance, in a greenhouse called Matzah Menutak down south or up further north, which are outside of the areas that were conquered by Olei Bavel, they'll use that during Shvi'it because of this concept that it doesn't necessarily have the Kedusha and it may not have Shvi'it applied to it in those areas. So we try with two kulot to allow for produce to be brought from those areas that are outside the areas of Olei Bavel, that are in the areas of what we call Olei Mitzrayim. So that's one of the ways that produce is brought up by the Otzar Aretz during the Shvi'it. Now, in terms of Maaser Ani, it's interesting, Tosafot over here notes that they could have just brought Maaser Ani. There is no din of Maaser during that year. He says, well, it really shouldn't have been Maaser Ani because the cycle works that you have first 2 years is Maaser Sheni, third year is Maaser Ani. Next 2 years, fourth and fifth year, are Maaser Sheni. Sixth year is Maaser Ani. That means the seventh year begins a new cycle. It should have been Maaser Sheni. I don't think it's such a strong argument because the truth is the first year of the cycle begins the year after Shvi'it. But those who want to say it should have been Maaser Sheni. Nevertheless, because they wanted to support the Aniim, they made it Maaser Ani. And he says, truthfully, they wouldn't even have to take off Chuma. The whole point is just support the Aniim. They could just take off Maaser Ani and nothing else. But he says they didn't want to differentiate it from all the other years and make it, oh, just Maaser Ani this year. So they kept intact all the normal matanot that come, all the masrot that normally are taken off, the truma, the maaser rishon, and the trumat maaser, they kept those even though they weren't necessary in order to make it like other years, and they took off maaser ani in order to support the aniim during the shvi'it. So then, tana, l'achashin yashva dato, after Rabbi Eliezer calmed down, amar, yihi ratzon sheyachzeru einei yosi limkoman, that his eyes should go back in their sockets, v'chazeru, and sure enough, they went back into their sockets. So the Talmidim of Rabbi Yeshua were aware of this story, and therefore they were treading lightly, because they knew that here, when he showed up and told them what they learned in the Beit Midrash that day, Rabbi Eliezer got all angry. What do you mean this is a chiddush? This is something that is well known for a long time. You think you're bringing me something new. So they were afraid to do the same thing with Rabbi Yeshua. So Rabbi Yeshua first has to quell them and encourage them to say something. I guess in a sense, protect them from being punished. Tarabanan, Ezuhu Shoteh. Now this is a very important discussion. Who is considered to be a shoteh? As our Mishnah notes, that a shoteh is patur from Riyah, he's also patur mikol mitzvot ha-Torah. So the definition or the criterion for shoteh are very important. So here the Gemara says, Hayotze yechidi balayla, someone who goes out alone at night. Obviously today that is less applicable, but in their day, if you went out alone at night, that was a dangerous endeavor, both because of the animals as well as the marauders that were out. Balan bebeit ha-kvarot, someone who sleeps in cemeteries. And someone who rips up his clothing, rents his carpet. So Itmar, Ravuna Mar, Ajiu Kulan Bavatachat. They all, you have to do all of them in one shot in order to be considered or classified as a shoteh. Yochanan Mar, Afil Bavachat Mehen. Even one of them suffices. Hechi Dami. What is the case here? Ida Abilu Derech Shtut. If he does them like someone who is deranged, Afil Bachadanami. Even one of them, no matter what you do, then it should be that he's classified as a shoteh. If a person is clearly acting deranged, then he is deranged. Even if he's not doing it in a deranged or maniacal way, then afilu kulunami, he could do all these things. Then it's not something that would consider him to be a shoteh. Or it says, lo, the olam tkavidlu derech shtut, he's doing them in a way that seems deranged. Valan bebeit ha-kvarot, the one who sleeps in the cemetery, yimor kadeshu tishra lav ruach tuma. He's doing it because he wants to have the Ruach Tumah descend upon him so he can do, whether it's sorcery or witchcraft, he wants to be part of that world of Ruach Tumah. Who the Kavit? That's why he's doing it. He was captured by either some sort of anxiety, Rashi says, or some sort of overheating, and he needs to go air out and cool himself off. So he's running out. He might look deranged, but there might be a good reason why he's going out at night. He's someone who is absent-minded, absorbed in his thoughts, someone who is a little bit captured by his imagination, and that's why he's ripping his clothing. So now, Kevin Dabdino the Kulu, Havalu, so once he does all of them, Havalu Kamish Nagach Shor Chamor V'Gamal. said machloket in the Gemara in Baba Kama with regards to making a shor into a shor mu'ad. How do you determine that he's already wild and he will continue to act in this behavior? So he said, if a shor goes ahead and gores a donkey, a camel, and an ox, then asim mu'ad b'kol. Then he becomes mu'ad for everything. I mean that this animal is not discerning, number one, and number two is that he gores. So that makes him into a wild animal. So too over here, with regards to the shotel over here, if the shotel does each one individually, even if he does it derech shtut, that doesn't mean that he is a shotel, because we can justify his behavior. Since we can justify his behavior, we'll say maybe he's not a shotel. So he has to do all three of them to prove to us that his behavior or deranged behavior is really making him into a shotel. You can explain each one of them. But if you have to explain all of them, then you have a problem, because to explain away or to justify one of them, that's fine. But if he does all three of them already, then you can't justify anymore. The common denominator between all of them is that he is a shotet, that he is deranged. So that's the way that Rav Huna will learn it. There's a question as to what that means or what the implications are for Rav Yochanan. Rav Yochanan over here says that you only need one. This is explaining Rav Huna's position, which you need all three. So it might be that Rav Huna requires all three different types, because he wants to show the common denominator is this deranged individual. Rav Yochanan might suffice by doing one of them three times. It's enough to say if he does it once, you can justify it. If he keeps doing it over and over again, then it's hard to justify that as being, you know, I want to rule off tuman, da-da-da. Then you already would say that it's a behavior that and invites an explanation that he is a shotet. So that might be the way to explain Rabbi Yochanan. Then Amar Rav Papa, Ishmile the Rav Huna had the Tanya. Rav Huna heard this braita. Ezu shotet, who was a shotet? Zemabeid kol mashinodim lo. He loses everything that you give him. He's unable to be responsible to hold on to things. That's called a shotet. So have a halderbe. He would have retracted or recanted his position. So over here you see a braita that says you only need one thing to be called a shotet. That goes against Rav Huna's position here where you need multiple items to prove that the individual is deranged, that that's the common denominator. So the bailu, ki have a halderbe, mimikarek, sutohu da have a halderbe. Would it be only retracted or recanted on ripping or tearing one's clothing? I assume that's because of the similarity between them. Some, when you give something property and they lose it, they're not responsible. That is similar to the idea of ripping one's clothing, where they do not consider ownership or property to be important, and therefore they rip their clothes or they throw away whatever you give them, and they lose whatever they give them. Because it's similar. So therefore he would have agreed that if it was just tearing one's clothing, that would make him a shoteh. You wouldn't need all three of them. Or maybe he would have attracted and said all of them. Any one of them would suffice to make him into a shoteh. Or would he still require by the other two? Alan bebeit akbarot. And Ayotzev Yechidi Balayla, he would still require all three or more information in order to make him or classify him as a shoteh. The Gemara leaves that as a teku unresolved. Again, obviously in the modern era, in terms of being classified as a shoteh, it does have implications both in chiyuva mitzvot, but also has implications, unfortunately, with the issues of agunot. A husband who becomes a shoteh or deranged, loses his mind, and then is incapable of giving a get, that leaves a woman as an aguna. You have to determine whether the husband is capable of giving a get in those cases. That will pivot or rely on this definition. What is a shotet? You have to determine whether he is of sound enough mind to give the get and understand what he's doing, versus he's a complete shotet, and therefore to ask him to give a get would be meaningless, because he's a shotet and he's patur, and he can't grant a get. So obviously in the modern day, the poskim deal with this. They mostly look at the information that's given here and the definition of a shoteh here as paradigmatic ways of trying to understand when is a person deranged, not necessarily the sole way to determine whether a person is a shoteh. There are those that think that these are the exact definitions, and that makes it much harder to clear that threshold. But most believe that here the Gemara is giving you examples of what would be considered deranged behavior, and therefore we try to look for evidence of that behavior, but not just one. We try to look for numerous or patterns of behavior that make us classify this individual as a shoteh. Okay, we'll stop here by the two dots on the top of Daled Amud Aleph.